Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be talking about mind power more in the context of individual power, resourcefulness, a willingness to take risk, and also to dare to walk a different direction than most people would choose. My guest today is Barbara Jo, and her book was one that absolutely gripped me, not just mentally, but emotionally and spiritually as well, because this woman has done a journey that I think is absolutely awesome, and she was not 20 years old when she took it on. No, no, no. She was in her 60s. Her book is titled Triumph and Hope. It is the best new nonfiction finalist National Indie Excellent Award, and this is an incredible story. Barbara Jo, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Donna. Thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here. And may I just say something briefly about my last name? It's by virtue of my Korean father-in-law, and people say to me, Barbara Jo, what's your last name? Jo is my last name. And even after I was divorced, I kept it, and my kids have it, and so I'm Barbara Jo in perpetuity.
Into perpetuity. Well, I think that's terrific. Barbara Jo, I want people to know a little bit about you. We're going to find out more as we talk today. You're a native of Boston, Massachusetts. You've got a BA degree in sociology and an MA in political theory and public administration the UC of Berkeley.
Did your homework.
Yes, ma'am. I've got it right in front of me. You've been a human rights activist for well over 30 years. You have lived or traveled in 45 different countries, and you are anything but adapting to a rocking chair as a woman who is now in her 70s. You are a freelance writer. You're also a Spanish interpreter and translator, and you live in Washington, D.C.
Right, and I was doing an interpretation this morning. Today, I do it almost every weekday, for a young woman who has mental disabilities. They were evaluating her for a special work.
Mm-hmm. You're a woman that, as I was saying to my audience right at the beginning, you have dared to, in what would often be described as your senior years, instead of saying, well, I'll just sit back in a rocking chair, watch TV, and live in Florida. That's not what you decided to do. In fact, you say right in the beginning of your book that Lillian Carter, President Carter's mother, was an inspiration to you because at 66, she joined the Peace Corps, I believe, and she served as a nurse in India, which I was unaware of.
She was an inspiration to me, and I thought if she can do it, and believe me, other people can do it too, not just me and Miss Lillian. I hope that people listening will consider it. It's not too late. There's a woman, 85 now in Morocco, who is with the Peace Corps. So,
85 years old, you know, in our world, I think the aspect of aging is being looked at much differently than it was 20 years ago. Because we have so many people that are saying, forget this nonsense of this archaic idea that we're to take all the knowledge we have and just sort of sit on our buns with it and not do anything. That's not the case. I am finding so many people like you who are becoming actively involved in community or global activities, and they're saying, wait a minute, I've spent my life acquiring a level of knowledge and learning. Why am I going to dump the baby with the bathwater, so to speak? Why not be out there contributing? And my hat's off to you. I think it's absolutely awesome.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, and I felt the Peace Corps is now recognizing that, and they're trying to to increase the number of older volunteers. I think it's about 8% now. Of course, the average age is still 28. It's younger people. But I thought we had certain advantages. We had more knowledge and skills to offer. We had experience. We enjoyed respect in the communities where we served. We were mentors to the younger people. We didn't so often get homesick and yearn for boyfriend or girlfriend back home or mom and dad. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that we had more to offer, even though we were in a minority. Now, there are a couple caveats to that in that older people, if they don't already know another language and they're put in a country where they have to learn it, it's harder when you're older. Fortunately, I knew Spanish already. And the other thing is sometimes older people have health problems more often than younger people. However, the Peace Corps is very accommodating to certain health problems. I started a support group for older people that's still going in Honduras called Oaks. We had an oak tree. That was our symbol. Mm-hmm. Older and knowing souls. And there was a member of that group who had diabetes, insulin dependent. The Peace Corps supplied her with that. They put her in a place where she had a refrigerator, and they accommodated to that. And I also know other volunteers. I know a woman who was blind who was in the Peace Corps. I've met several people who were deaf who taught English, American Sign Language in English-speaking countries like Kenya or in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And there's been at least one person that I know of in a wheelchair who has served as a Peace Corps as a volunteer. So they will accommodate if the person is willing to put themselves forward.
Now let's do a little bit of background history on you, because you have been going to Honduras for over 10 years with the Peace Corps affiliation, but you had a history with that country. And your book opens up with 1941, and you were in Copan, Honduras. Tell us what was going on in 1941.
Well, my parents, my dad is originally from Stavely, Alberta in Canada, and my mother from Duluth, Minnesota. They met at the University of Minnesota in the architecture department, and they had two small children in 1941, myself. I was not even 3 years old, and a brother a year and a half. I'm amazed that they picked up and decided to go to Central America. They had a Model A Ford and a house trailer, made their way down there. My dad, who was an architect, both of my parents were architects, at that time, they weren't so fussy about your credentials. He wasn't an archaeologist, but he did work for 6 months in the Copan Mayan ruins. And in my book, I have a picture of a statue that he found the pieces of, the maize god. He put mm-hmm. it together. And what a thrill to me when I'm assigned to Honduras and I go to Copan and go to the museum and see this statue in the museum. So here, 60 years later, I come back to Honduras.
You have had heartbreak in your life.
Yes, absolutely.
Your son died at the age of 27.
Right.
And that was devastating to you. You've had four children. You
right.
have three children that are very productive human beings. And this, in part, really made you aware that you didn't want to stagnate, that, and I'll quote from your book, death gives no second chances, no opportunities for course corrections, no refunds or reprieves. And it really changed you psychologically. It affected you, obviously, physically, mentally, and emotionally, and spiritually. And you really went through some interesting situations. You were dating a man and that wasn't working, and then you had a foster son by the name of Alex, who was also to not be long in your life, and he had AIDS.
Yes, I have to say it's very devastating to lose a younger person. You know, I think we expect our parents to die, our spouses, our siblings maybe, but we always think the next generation is going to carry on, and to lose them, it's, well, I'm not over it. You know, even now, my son died in 1994, and my foster son, my son was Andrew, and my foster son Alex, who was from Cuba, died in 1995, and I'm not over it, but I think it helped me to be in the Peace Corps, to be in another environment, to be active and doing something, and also in a situation in Honduras, unfortunately, child deaths are more common, and I was certainly able to offer sympathy to parents. And I also felt, strangely enough, or maybe it's just my imagination, that my son, Andrew, was with me on that journey and that he was encouraging me. So that helped me to stay the course when I had some difficult times. And I ended up actually staying in Honduras beyond the normal 27 months. I was there 3.5 years. I extended my time. And may I mention the title of my book, Triumph and Hope, is based on the two towns that I served in. One was El Triunfo, the Triumph, and I was there a little over 2 years, and then later I was in La Esperanza, the Hope, a little more than 1 year.
You say in the beginning chapter of your book, many are called, few are chosen. And this is the case with the Peace Corps, because they have, and I want to go into this a little bit, because you just don't walk up, say, hi, I want to join the Peace Corps, and then la, 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 you're off to, you know, wherever you think you're going to go.
Hardly.
Yeah, you've got a very detailed application that has to be filled out. You have to be in excellent health. They don't want sick people.
No, although they will accommodate some things. Like you mentioned, the diabetes.
This is something that they can accommodate. But if you have chronic influenza or something like this, they're not going to take you. They can't, because you're going to be living in exceptionally, rigorously difficult physical circumstances.
Right.
And you really have to be educated. Your fingerprints are taken, and they're sent to the FBI. You have to have detailed references. They give you interviews with regional recruiters. And sometimes this interviewing process can take over a year.
Absolutely.
And there are over 8,000 volunteers in more than 70 countries, and apparently Mexico, according to what you've said, is brand new in having volunteers in the Peace Corps. But you say that technical skill is not a volunteer's most important attribute. Gaining trust of the people that you're going to be interacting with is absolutely paramount. So they probably also give you a personality test to find out whether or not you're going to be people friendly.
Well, I think they do that in a very extensive interview, and of course you also have references. And part of it is, if you can get through this process, which is very rigorous to apply, I think they think, well, this person has what it takes to stay the course in the Peace Corps. And the interview is, they do reject people on the interview, and they don't always tell them why they reject them. But I know people who have been rejected. So, yes, you have to impress the interviewer is a person who has been in the Peace Corps, so they know what it's about.
Right. They've walked the walk. You decided you wanted to go to Honduras. And, of course, because of your background and your family's background, it would be a natural, really. I mean, you spoke Spanish fluently. The Honduran environment was something that you had a little bit of familiarity with. Now, when you went there in the year 2000, Honduras ranked 107th among 162 nations on the United Nations Human Development Index. That says a lot. That says a huge amount.
Yeah, it's a country very undeveloped. Maybe after Haiti, it's the poorest and most undeveloped country in Latin America. I don't know. Nicaragua and Honduras are kind of at a par, but it has a long way to go, and that's why they're so anxious to have Peace Corps volunteers there, and they're very hospitable to us.
Yes, they're very good people. Of course, I think people are pretty good everywhere. I think it's just the political rhetoric and everything else that gets in the way, my bias, of course. Hondurans live on less than a dollar a day.
Many of them.
And some of them don't have any income whatsoever. Illiteracy is extremely high, extremely high. And you talked about the crime, and most of the money that was acquired by the people came from those Hondurans that had managed to get into the United States and were working. They do the same thing that many of the Mexican people do, or people that have families, or East Indians do. I mean, I met people in New York that flew into New York to get a job because they couldn't get a job in India.
Well,
and they were there in New York, and their money, most of it, goes back into India. So the same thing with the Hondurans. And you said more than $150 million was being returned in the form of remittances, a figure that would reach $1 billion by the time you were no longer going there, on, you know, spending a whole bunch of time there, and almost $2.5 billion by 2007, fully 25% of their GDP, constituting a backdoor form of foreign aid.
Yeah, now I suspect that that amount has gone down somewhat now with this recession, the income, and certainly Honduras has been affected by our recession, and of course I go there every year. I'm going there now in the beginning of February. I go for the month of February every year. I participate in medical brigades, and I'm helping some kids with higher ed education. I work with a blind school there, school for blind children, and also a rehabilitation center. So I spend every February there, and I'm fortunate with my work that I'm a Spanish interpreter, but I'm an independent contractor, so if I don't work, I'm not paid, but I can go. And they know in February I'm not going to be available.
You talk about the language, and of course, they have what I will use the term that we use here, a type of slang. They have a way of speaking, and if people are not familiar with it, it really can be almost funny, but it can also be disastrous if you don't know the language well. And you teach people the differences between English and Spanish, but you talk about homophones when it comes to language. I'd never heard that term before. What is that?
Well, those are words that would sound alike in both languages, but they may or may not mean the same thing, and that can trick you up if you think, well, if I say embarazada, you know, it sounds like embarrassed in English, but in Spanish it means you're pregnant, so you don't want to, so you don't want to say, are you embarrassed, you know, if you don't want to use that word in Spanish, because even though they sound alike, they aren't the same, and they don't mean the same. So,
well, like it's like relaciones, that is has a sexual connotation
in
Spanish, but if for someone of English background, it says, okay, relations, so we would think that of family. No, it's something else.
Well,
so we really have to know about the language when you go to these places.
Absolutely. And people say, sometimes they'll say éxito. They think that's the exit, and that really means success. Or they'll say finis, you know, at the end of something, and that means something that's very tiny or fine, and that doesn't mean it's the end. And so those were some things that volunteers who weren't so conversant with the language had to learn. I did my best to help them. I fortunately knew it already, but I did have to learn some of the Honduran slang because I was not familiar with that.
Let's talk about health for a minute.
Okay.
In this country, we take so much for granted. And sanitation, sewage treatment, these things in our country, when you look at history, are relatively new. Many of the conditions that you describe about the Honduran environment, the people, what they're having to live with, was in this country not all that long ago.
No.
It's amazing how easy it is for people today to be unaware of this, to be unaware of fresh running water that we take for granted because of the infrastructure that has been developed in our nation. Now, it's not everywhere in our nation, because we have areas in our country, in the United States, that are still just as bad as what people are seeing in Honduras. But I thought it was fascinating, the fact that when you go from the, when you're with the Peace Corps, you don't have funds or anything at your disposal. You're there to inform, to educate, and to help people understand that there can be a better environment for them and their families. And when you went over, you were primarily concerned with maternity care, midwifery, and HIV prevention, nutrition, infant care, and child survivor, because so many of the children die under the age of five, and diarrhea is very common with these children. They dehydrate. They just don't survive.
They don't have pure enough water, and that was one of the things we did, was show them either to boil or chlorinate the water. And if the child gets sick, you have to keep hydrating them, and we taught them how to make a solution of purified water with salt, a certain amount of salt, and sugar to keep the child hydrated, because they could die of dehydration.
Right, and I remember a long time ago, people, especially when they were dealing with malnutrition with children, with babies, they would make rice water. And, of course, if you had the rice, these Hondurans don't have the rice.
Some of them do.
In certain parts of the world. But it all depends on what they have available to them. But the rice water gave them, along with a little sugar and a little salt, gave the babies enough where they had a chance of surviving.
Mm-hmm.
But their little tummies just couldn't, you know, have very much. And you talk in here about a young trainee that absolutely broke down, fell apart, was in tears, because she had seen nothing but filth and dark, crowded wards in hospitals, filthy floors mopped by women that were using filthy water. I saw that in Russia.
Oh, you did.
Oh, yes. There's things that I've seen. And, again, I've even seen stuff in the United States. But there are things that go on, and people don't have these supplies. I mean, these Hondurans can't go out to a 7-Eleven and pick up a bottle of Clorox. And,
absolutely,
you know,
not.
They're not able to do this. So when you were involved with this, did you find that one of the biggest things that women were concerned about was birth control, how they could keep from getting pregnant? Because the women would get pregnant over and over and over again. They had no birth control. Am I correct?
Yeah. Right, and especially in rural areas. Now, I think it's less so now. And it seemed that their husbands were the ones that wanted them to have a lot of children. And sometimes they would secretly go to the health center and get some kind of injection that lasts for 3 months, and they just wouldn't get pregnant. But they wouldn't tell the husband that they were doing that, because the husbands, I guess, they thought it was more macho to have more children.
And, well, that's part of the cultural environment.
Yeah, but I had one woman that I knew there. She had given birth to 21 children, if you can imagine.
Oh.
And her husband left. I said, well, that's a good thing.
After 21, it took him that long? Oh, gee whiz.
She said, well, I think I have a couple more in me. I said, no, I think you've had enough.
21 children.
Right.
Well, again, there was a time in the United States where that was pretty common.
Mm-hmm.
And I had talked to a social worker, a health worker, that when she was in Mexico, she said that was one of the biggest things. Women would travel for miles when they knew health workers, you know, internationally were coming in. And they would make excuses. They would lie because they wanted to not have any more children. They couldn't even feed the children they were giving birth to.
Mm-hmm.
And their children died or were sick or they were sick. And if the mother dies, then what happens to the kids? And so
yeah,
many times the men are not employed.
That's right. Well, now the birth rate has started to come down. Tubal ligations are very popular. And once the woman has it, often they have it if they give birth in a hospital,
mm-hmm.
at the time of the birth, they just ask to have it done. And it's too late. The husband can't complain once
mm-hmm.
it's done. It's over.
And that's so, it. And that really is something I think that empowers the women in a very special way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk, and I know we're going to be going to break in a few minutes here, so will you be able to stay with me for an additional
Sure.
Because I think that what you tell about in your book, Triumph and Hope, and your experiences are invaluable. Because I think it gives us not just a little dinky window view into different cultural environments, but it gives us a bay window view with a big circle of glass. So we see different perspectives, and I really appreciated that. One of the things you bring out is how dangerous it is for single women to travel in the Peace Corps. And when you had signed up, you said they were do the best they can to protect volunteers. And I heard just a clip of something. I didn't hear the whole story yesterday. Just a clip of something on the radio where some Peace Corps volunteer was in some place. I don't even know what area she was in. And she was raped multiple times, and she was kept a prisoner, and all of this kind of stuff. I didn't hear the whole story.
Mm,
and
I wonder what country that was.
I don't know. I just heard a little bit. So here's this about this one incident, and I'm not saying that it's horrific, anything like that happening. But at the time when you went in, 250 volunteers had died in service since 1961. There were 20 murders in that number and 16 suicides.
Mm-hmm.
And I was astonished to find that Honduras has the highest incident of HIV in Central America.
Yes.
That was just amazing.
Mm-hmm. That was one of our tasks, was to make people aware of that, that you can be contagious and not show any symptoms whatsoever.
Right.
And in Honduras, it's kind of like Africa, where frankly, the husband gives it to the wife in most cases, but
mm-hmm.
it's heterosexual. Although I think it's leveled off some since I was there, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
People are getting the message of how you get it.
Well, and the thing is that the children get it. If the women get it, they can get it. And then the children are dying. The women are dying. You don't have anybody to take care of the kids. It's a big problem that they've got in Africa. The men
mm-hmm.
are not able to work, and whole families are dying. And so you have this abundance of orphans that what are they going to do when their children, they can't do anything, they can't work, they're not going to have any means to support themselves. So it's really quite a tragedy. Now, I know we're going to be going to break here. For those of you listening, my guest today is Barbara Jo. Her book is Triumph and Hope. Now, Barbara Jo is in her 70s at this time, but her story is something that is absolutely incredible. And when we come back, we're going to be sharing some more information with you. So do stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Donna Sebo again interviewing Barbara Jo, her book Triumph and Hope. She's in Washington, D.C. I'm in the Pacific Northwest, and our studio is in California. And aren't you grateful for the wonderful aspects of technology that enable us to bring wonderful people like her to the airwaves? We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in Physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Rio. I'm the author of the cutting-edge book, Hooked on Raw. I want to give you and your loved ones the gift of optimum health. So when you order my book, Hooked on Raw, which has over 350 delicious, healthy recipes, I'll include my new DVD, What's Not Cooking in Rio's Kitchen, for a half price. Just go to my website, rawfoodinfo.com, and click on Holiday Special. That's rawfoodinfo.com. Click on Holiday Special.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hello, this is Donna. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Barbara Jo. She is in her 70s, has been a Peace Corps volunteer since she was 62. So we're going to learn more about the Honduran environment that she has such a passion for. She loves the people, and she was there doing things that most of us in a million years probably would not even want to get close to. But it's a wonderful, wonderful book, Triumph and Hope. Now, Barbara, you talk about some cultural aspects that I found extremely intriguing. Your clarity, your openness in discussing this, I think is absolutely awesome. Homosexuality, you said, is not recognized by the Hondurans at all. And you talked about this. They just say, no, it doesn't exist. In fact, if someone was known as a homosexual, they could end up being killed. How was this handled in their society? I mean, in any culture I've ever known, there have always been people that have had that kind of a patterning. Now, I don't consider it good or bad. It's just part of life. But what was your experience with this?
Well, I would say there are people with gay or homosexual tendencies, but they're married. Everyone there is married, and so they just go both ways. And that's one of the problems with the HIV, the proliferation of it, is that that is the case. I think it just is ignored that they are doing that. There was a couple that I met where they were, one of them that was cross-dressing, if you will, and they were living together, two men. And people just kind of ignored them, and the one that took on the feminine role wore a dress and had long hair and cooked and did the traditional feminine things. So they just kind of, I think they know that it exists, and it certainly does exist, but they just don't acknowledge it. And among volunteers, they were not supposed, if they were gay, they weren't supposed to reveal it, and they didn't. And so they kept it a secret, and they would sometimes invent an opposite sex girlfriend or boyfriend in the United States that was waiting for them, supposedly. But no, it just is not. It's very forbidden in the culture. My landlady had two grandsons, and this was in a small town, the first town, El Triunfo. Doña Marina was her name. Two grandsons died while I was there, and the female partner of one. Now, I don't know their sexual orientation or whether how they acquired AIDS, these two guys, but it could have been from other men. And there was certainly a doctor in our town, in that town, who was reputed to be gay, was rumored, but of course no one would say it out loud, and he died while I was there. So AIDS was very much alive, if you will, or visible. And of course I had experience with it because my foster son from Cuba had AIDS. He was gay, and I think that he had come to this country originally in 1980 with the boat lift. I don't know if your listeners remember that, the Mariel boat lift. He was in jail. He was 16, and he never told me why he was in jail, but at that time in Cuba, they were jailing people who were gay, and of course, he died of AIDS. And but I had experience with it, and so I certainly could recognize in Honduras when people were failing and going through that process. But it was very much covered up, and it, on a death certificate, they would beg the doctor not to put AIDS, to put something else. You know, he had kidney failure or something, and because they didn't even want the stigma of that on the death certificate.
You also talked about how the Jewish people, the Jewish trainees, were warned not to speak of their religion. And I thought this was amazing, because here you have a South American country. Why would there be an anti-Jewish sentiment? But well, it was very, very strong. Why would that be there?
I don't know. It was strongest just before Easter, where, you know, they would say, well, the Jews killed Jesus, and the children would play a game where they were killing the Jews. And it just, of course, there are very few Jewish people in Honduras. Most of them are foreigners, and it's just not part of their tradition. They're all, most of them are Catholic, and there's a growing evangelical population, but Christian only. And there is an anti-Jewish sentiment, I would have to say. We had a volunteer whose wife was Catholic, and he would go to Mass with her, and he never said he was Jewish, but he was. And it was just safer not to mention it.
You also bring out facts about Asian Americans, African Americans. Asian Americans were called chinitos or chinita. That meant little Chinaman or China woman. And people would just do this. They're not even... and here in America, we have our political correctness on so many levels. And you're in this country, they don't have it. So you really have to be aware. And African Americans, you said, really had to be aware that they were going to be called negrito or negrita, little blacky or just plain ugly one, fio fia, since dark skin is openly devalued. And I thought, whoa, wow, that would be a cultural shock, wouldn't it?
Yes, and it was to many of them, although there are Hondurans who are black, but still there is a prejudice against dark, and blonde and fair skin is valued very heavily. And even within a family, the lightest skinned child is considered the most beautiful. My own, you know, I mentioned that my last name is Korean, and my daughter, who's part Asian, Stephanie, one of my daughters, came to visit me, and they called her Chinita. She looks somewhat Asian, and she did not take offense, but some of the volunteers, especially initially, did take offense, and rightly so, I would say. We tried to kind of dampen people's prejudices, if you will. But they that to them was just normal. And sometimes being a black can be a term of endearment, too. Sometimes they'll say, "You're my blackie," a man might say to his wife or something. So it has a double meaning, but basically it's not so good to be dark-skinned, dark-haired, or dark anything.
You know, I found that you bring out so much of the cultural aspect, but then the heartbreaking side is the dealing with the lack of nutrition. And they talk about babies that are born with split spines, hydrocephalia and spinal bifida, that's due to folic acid insufficiency, and all of these things. And the men did not want their wives to go to clinics that had been set up. They absolutely would forbid them to go in and get any kind of medical care. And these babies, if they survived, I mean, there are places in the world like India where cleft palates, and I don't know if they're very much of that in Honduras, but
yes, there was.
You have these horrific physical conditions that a child can be born with because the mother is nutritionally deficient, and yet the mentality of the men in these areas is, no, you don't do this. You don't, because they don't have any understanding. They honest to God, don't realize that they could have beautiful, healthy children if they understood this. What was your biggest challenge in dealing with the men relative to assisting women along these lines? How did you get around this?
It was harder to reach the men. Of course, I'm a woman, and most of my work was with women, and I had in villages around the main towns where I worked, I trained helpers, women, who are still doing it, and when I go back every year, I kind of encourage them. It was hard to get the men on board, and of course, with this folic acid, it's mostly in wheat products. They have corn tortillas, they have beans, they have rice, none of that has folic acid. And these medical brigades that I still participate in now when I go, I participate in one, especially International Health Service of Minnesota. It's not only for Minnesotans. I've also worked with Operation Smile. I'm sure you know of that, that has the hair lip and cleft palate. I work with another one, Cure International, that does club foot. And all of that, if they had sufficient folic acid, you could prevent most of that, including spina bifida. And so what we tried to do as volunteers was, first of all, to encourage people to vary their diet, because they just mostly have tortillas and beans, to plant vegetables. Raw spinach, for instance, has folic acid. If you could incorporate that into the diet, that would help. It's an uphill struggle, though. And the bread, if you bought a loaf of bread, it would be fortified with folic acid. But most of the people we were working with never bought food that was manufactured. They made their corn tortillas and they grew their beans, and that was it. They grew their corn, and that was subsistence, really. All this kind of thing that we have to do with the medical brigades to remedy these problems, they could be prevented in large part.
And that's a process of education, and one of the things that you bring out in your book, one of many things. I mean, it's really eye-opening. And we have had to do the same thing in the United States, and we still have to do it. And we still have to do it throughout the world. People have to be convinced they can improve their situation. They have to know it and to have the motivation to do the steps necessary. And that is the biggest challenge we have today. I don't care where you go in the world. How do you motivate people to take the steps? Barbara Jo, I know we're just about out of time here. I have so enjoyed having you as a guest. I think that your book is absolutely awesome. People can go to your website, which is HonduraspeaceCorps.blogspot.com. That's Honduras Peace Corps, and that's CORPS.blogspot.com.
Peace Corps.
And so you'll know that you can get it there. It's at any of the big bookstores. The book is Triumph and Hope.
And it's on Amazon.com specifically. That's probably the easiest way.
Right. And her information about the Peace Corps, her information in the book is absolutely mind-boggling. I think if you have a student, a young person, that doesn't believe that things like this go on in the world, this is a must-read. I'm telling you, it is something that I think is a book that says, wake up, be aware. You cannot take anything for granted. You may like to, and we are able to do it to a point, but if we're not vigilant, we can end up in a situation that would be like the Dark Ages, if we're not willing to do what we have to do to improve our culture, our thinking, our environment. And Barbara Jo, I just think you've done a fabulous job with this. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I've enjoyed talking with you.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be gone for just a moment or two, so don't go away. More good things to share, and we'll be back in just a moment. Triumph and Hope by Barbara Jo, J-O-E. Get the book. You will be astonished at what you read. We'll be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Rio, host of the Hooked on Raw radio show on rawenergyradio.com. If you're interested in the raw and living food lifestyle, along with the real story of what's happening to our health freedoms, and you don't mind a little controversy, listen to my radio show and podcasts on rawenergyradio.com. Each week, we interview guests and cover topics you won't hear on mainstream radio. Get informed, healthy, and involved. RawEnergyRadio.com.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604. 582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone line is going to be open if you'd like to give me a quick call. 888-815-9756 is the telephone number to call into. That's 888-815-9756. Quick like a bunny, I want to share with you who is going to be my guests or my guests. Yes, plural, next week. We're going to be talking with a Peruvian shaman on Monday. Her name is Sylvia. I had the pleasure of meeting her a year ago here in the Pacific Northwest, and she told me she'd be coming back. I said, I'd like to have you as a guest. So we're going to be hearing stories about her life, how she became a shaman, how she learned about the tools that she was to use, the cocoa leaf, the value in their society of that particular product, etc. Then on Tuesday, we're going to be talking with Fred Haney, and his publication is My Doggy Says, Messages from Jamie. Just delightful, absolutely wonderful. Gina Misano intimacy after breast cancer. And I know we've got a caller. Let me get out these last two guests for next week. Next Thursday, The Art of Navigation, Felix Wolf. In-depth awareness of how you can make your life richer and better. And then Bringing Progress to Paradise, Jeffrey Raisley is going to be my guest. Another world traveler. Incredible people doing incredible things. Aren't we fortunate that we're able to get their stories? Oh, I think we are. Let's go to our first caller. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
Hi, Donna. It's Catherine from Canada.
Hi, Catherine. Where are you in Canada?
I'm near Machine, New Brunswick.
Brunswick, wonderful. Well, welcome to the show. Okay, now the thing, Catherine, that I wanted to say right off the bat is you're doing a good job. You have started off the new year with a sense of clarity. And these little tiny baby steps that you're taking to get everything in order, great. Don't be too anxious. It may take you longer to get everything secured and in place the way you want it to be. Let's say you were trying to shred documents for the past 10 years. Well, maybe you're only able to do so much every day, or maybe just pick a day, and you're only able to do something for a few hours because of interruptions. Just know that you're going to be able to meet your deadline, and it's going to be efficiently produced and followed through with. Also, something that is very significant in my mind about you is that you're peeling away some paradigms of thinking that you've had. It's like you're going inside yourself and you're really asking questions. Am I seeing things clearly? Am I looking at a particular event or situation or concern with beliefs that I've had from the past? If I stand back and detach myself from it, how am I seeing it? And I compliment you on this because I'm seeing you little by little just stripping away some things that no longer apply to you, your life, how you wish to live your life. You're making some wonderful strides, Catherine. Don't beat yourself up because you haven't done it in 30 seconds. You cannot do it in 30 seconds. It doesn't happen that quickly. Take your time. Take advantage of this slower period. Be methodical. You're going to be amazed at how much you conquer and how much you accomplish. What was your question for me, dear?
I'd like to know what you see happening in my marriage.
I am looking at a level of stability in the marriage. I am seeing you recognizing that certain things are no longer going to be acceptable to you. That could be part of what I'm seeing you peeling away. And you're going to realize that you can be yourself. You don't need to be fearful. And that certain responsibilities are your husband. And he can handle those responsibilities and understand this is part of his growing up, if you will. That's the only way I know how to say it. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. He needs to be in control. And
No. Growing up is learning you don't have control over everybody and everything. So that is what I think you're dealing with. Hun, we're out of time, and I'm sorry that that's the case. But again, have patience with yourself. Realize you take little tiny baby steps, and you will take control of your space, your life.
Okay.
God bless you. Take care. And thank you so much for being with us today. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, it just went by like the wind, didn't it? Well, I'm going to be back with you on Monday, same time, same place. I hope you can join me. And we'll be talking with Sylvia, a shaman from Peru. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is your life. Own it. It doesn't belong to anybody else. It belongs to you. It's your right. But you're also responsible for your choices. There's no free ride here. You're going to have to earn the right to discover yourself. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you on Monday. You're the master of your fate. Don't forget, the master of your soul, the captain of your soul. Master of your fate, captain of your soul. God bless. Talk to you on Monday. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.